Within Palestine, Israel, a podcast of the Alternative Information Center. On Monday, July 23, 2007, Shir Hever, economic researcher with the Alternative Information Center, interviewed Professor Jonathan Nitzan about two recent articles which he co-authored with frequent collaborator Shimshon Bichler, titled Cheap Wars and Israel's Roaring Economy. Jonathan Nitzan is a professor of political economy at York University in Toronto, Canada, and the author of numerous articles and books dealing with the regional and international political economy, including The Global Political Economy of Israel, published in English in 2002, which he co-authored with Shimshon Bichler. The publications of Jonathan Nitzan and Shimshon Bichler, including the articles discussed in this interview, are freely available from the Bichler and Nitzan archives at bnarchives.net.
Hello, I would like to speak to you today about two articles that you've recently published. Both these articles have been published in the Alternative Information Center website as well as in your own website. These articles are Cheap Wars, and the other one is Israel's Roaring Economy. Both of these articles speak about a topic that has become recently very prominent in political discourse, about the connection between economic prosperity and military conflict. In the article Cheap Wars, you speak about the end of military Keynesianism. Could you maybe say a few words, what is military Keynesianism?
Hi, Shir. I think that we need to say maybe a little bit more than a few words on military Keynesianism, perhaps because some of the listeners are not familiar with the term. So I'd like to give, with your permission, some sort of a background on the development and the invention of this terminology and to put it in some historical context. First, in terms of the magnitudes that are involved, if you look at military spending and if you focus on the United States, which is the subject of many studies and it's still, in some sense, at least for the 20th century, has been the center of the global political economy. Military spending in the United States amounted to almost 45% during the Second World War as a percentage of the GDP, or the gross domestic product. This number since then has come down. It fell to about 15% during the Korean conflict that the U.S. was involved in, and then down to about 10% during Vietnam, and down further to about 7 or 7.5% during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, which involved the largest buildup, military buildup in peacetime. And it reached a very low level during the end of Clinton's presidency. Around 2000, it reached the level of 3.8% of GDP. Nowadays, it seems to be growing again, and it's approaching, I think, 4.5% or 5% of GDP in the United States. But in historical context, the magnitudes are really still very small in comparison to what happened in the middle of the 20th century. So we have to try to contextualize historically this downtrend. When people talk about the militarized economy, in fact, the economy of the U.S., has been demilitarized over the past half century.
And now, would that mean that the connection between the military buildup and economic profit is gradually being broken?
Well, before we come into the connection of military spending to profit, I'd like to still spend some time explaining the political context of military Keynesianism and why it might be a rather irrelevant concept today. The capitalism of the period after the Second World War was rather different from the one that we live in today. Now, many people tend to forget it, but the world has gone through a Great Depression in the 1930s, in which about a quarter of the labor force was unemployed, and the level of economic activity contracted immensely. This was a period of huge ideological challenges to capitalism, A, from Nazism and fascism, and B, from communism. So the system of laissez-faire capitalism was really questioned. And during the period, the ruling classes, the ruling capitalist classes, were not very confident in the future of capitalism. This was the context in which John Maynard Keynes could write a book in the 1930s that offered actually a revolution, an ideological and a theoretical revolution. He argued essentially you cannot just rely on laissez-faire. You can not rely on the automatic responses of the capitalist system. You have to think in aggregate terms, and you have to directly intervene in order to regulate the economy. Now, the structure of the political economy at the time was fairly peculiar in the sense that economies were relatively closed. There was a fairly limited movement in terms of exports and imports, and very limited movement of capital by today's standards. And finally, unions and labor more generally were pretty strong. In the United States, for example, the labor force was highly unionized. About a third of the labor force belonged to unions. So there was a specific historical context in which what was called a capital-labor accord was struck, in which workers received relatively high wages and relatively secured employment, at least organized labor, in return for staying out of domestic politics and foreign politics, and in return for accepting intervention in the economy that took the form of high military spending. This was the context of military Keynesianism with a backdrop of the Great Depression and the aftermath of the Great Depression. Now, if you compare this context to the world we live in now, you see a world of difference.
Yeah. In your article, you mentioned that during the 80s and the 90s, the regime of military Keynesianism was replaced by a different regime, which you call mergers and acquisitions.
I just want to continue the thought here about how the world is different before I can explain what the new regime is like. So if you look at what happens today, we have a situation in which the capitalist class is no longer fearful for the future of capitalism. The future of capitalism is not in question as it was in the 1930s or in the 1940s. Perhaps the only ideological challenge that capitalism now faces come from radical Islam, and even that is a fairly limited challenge. There is no belief in intervention anymore. Monetarism has basically won the economic discourse. The structure of the political economies is completely different. These are open political economies which capital is flowing pretty freely, and therefore it really neutralizes the effect of intervention quite effectively. Labor does not have to be placated anymore. You know, unionization in the United States now is marginal, and jobs are being exported into the periphery of the so-called emerging markets, no longer periphery anymore, actually. So there is no need for compromise, and there's no need for using military spending to prop up anything. So in that context, military spending really become a sidekick. It's not that war has no effect. War can have a significant effect, but the effects and the understanding of conflict in this situation is really very different. So that's why we are saying that in the article Cheap Wars, that military Keynesianism is actually no longer a relevant framework for understanding the global political economy.
So what has replaced military Keynesianism?
Well, we are not thinking of moving from military Keynesianism into something else. We are actually proposing a completely different framework for analysis. The existing approaches essentially are based on a fracture. What I mean by a fracture is that we think of society as a system that involves subsystems. So you have a system of economics, a system of politics, a system of culture, of ethnicity, of gender, etc. And all of these interact with one another, either positively or negatively. Now, our framework is rather different. We actually try to completely eliminate those fractures by arguing that we need to have a universal approach to the understanding of capitalism. And what we mean by that is that we have to think of capital not as an economic entity, because we reject this notion of economic to begin with. Capital is an organized institution of power, and in that capacity, it actually incorporates what others are treating as politics or as culture or as ethnicity and gender. All of these factors could be important, but they are to be understood, in our opinion, as part of this process of capital as power. So when we argue for an alternative, we actually come from a completely different methodological understanding of what are the relevant questions. If you think about power, power is a relative thing, and therefore we argue that the accumulation of capital should be understood differentially. That's why we talk about differential accumulation in our work. Differential accumulation means essentially the attempt and success of dominant capital groups, in other words, the leading groups at the center of the political economy, to beat the average. And that means to accumulate faster than the average. Differential accumulation is not an economic entity. It's not an economic process. It's actually a manifestation of the many intertwined power processes in society. So when we talk about differential accumulation, in fact, we are not talking about economics. Military Keynesianism essentially is a marriage between politics and economics. It says the economy is in trouble, use political means to prop up the economy. We are not thinking in those terms to begin with. We think about capital accumulation as a broad power process. Now, in terms of regimes, in terms of ways of understanding the history of capitalism, we are arguing that there are two main ways for dominant capital to achieve differential accumulation. One is what we call breadth, in which power is expanded either through proletarianization, which is what we see nowadays in countries such as China and India, in which the rural populations become integrated into the process of capitalization, or through mergers and acquisitions, which you mentioned in your question. So this is one broad regime of accumulation, of differential accumulation. The other broad regime is what we call depth, and that is something that involves the deepening of power structures, and this usually takes the form of conflict, crisis, and redistribution through inflation. So these are the two regimes in which differential accumulation progresses historically, we argue, and militarization fits into it, but in a very complex way, in a way that is really very radical, radically different from the fractured understanding of economics versus politics.
All right, but in that case, what is the actual difference between military Keynesianism and the sort of accumulation regime that you discussed during the 80s and the 90s?
Well,
despite the lower expenditures on military that you mentioned before.
Right. So during the 80s and 90s, we believe the global political economy was growing through a massive regime of breadth. In other words, the dominant capital expanded through the process of A, entering into the so-called emerging markets, increasingly China and India, through the proletarianization process, and also through a process of massive centralization through mergers and acquisitions. This was the dominant force that helped dominant capital beat the average during the 1980s, 1990s, up until maybe the early 2000s. Now, then this process came to an end for various reasons, and there was a series of crises and a collapse of mergers and acquisitions. And to compensate, in inverted commas, for this relative receding of the breadth regime, there emerged the alternative regime of depth. What we saw is a rise in conflict. We saw the beginning of what the Bush administration called the war on terror. We saw the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. And we saw the return of a threat of stagflation, rising oil prices, a revival of the threat of inflation. And we saw massive redistributions taking place as that as a consequence of that process. So,
Can you identify this redistribution? Who are the benefactors from this redistribution?
Of course you can identify this redistribution. You can identify it at several different layers. You can go very closely to the heart of the process and look at the oil companies. The oil companies accounted for about 20%, around 20% of all global profits in the 1980s. And due to the breadth regime, which was involving not stagflation but mergers and acquisitions, the role of the oil companies has really declined throughout the 1980s and 1990s, and their share of profit has gone down to about 3% around 2000. Now, since then, with a massive increase in the price of oil because of the conflict in the Middle East, in our opinion, the oil companies now account for 15-17% of global profit again. So there's been a massive redistribution in favor of those who are very close to the heart of the conflict, but that's just the very immediate circle. If you look at dominant capital groups, the process of differential accumulation through stagflation benefited them enormously. Even a marginal rise in inflation from about, say, 1.5% during the early 2000 to something like 3 or 4% presently, involved a massive redistribution from wages, which haven't risen, to profits, which have skyrocketed. So again, the role of war, if you like, by reviving inflation very significantly at the core in terms of oil prices and commodity prices, but also generally in terms of the increase in the overall price level, has caused massive redistribution from wages to profits, and specifically to the profits of large firms.
You've mentioned the concept of stagflation. For our listeners who do not know, this is a combination of inflation and recession. And this reminds me of something that you have written in the article Cheap Wars, that capitalists today are no longer afraid of recession. They might even encourage it. Can you explain that, please?
Well, maybe we should begin with the notion that capitalists, and this is, again, a confusion that lingers from the periods of the classical political economists that associates capital accumulation with economic growth. They tend to be thought of as synonyms. People talk about growth and about capitalism in one breath. I think capitalists are not interested in growth. Capitalists are interested in the accumulation of capital. And in our view, they are specifically interested in the differential accumulation of capital. And that differential accumulation can occur, as I suggested earlier, either through breadth expansion or depth expansion. Now, depth, which is associated mostly, in our view, with inflation and stagflation, often comes with a crisis. But let's think of what happens in a crisis. For the sake of argument, let's say that the economy, however measured, contracts, and that profits actually are flat or even going down. Now, if you're thinking, of capital as an absolute process or an absolute entity that expands in the aggregate, then, of course, this is signifying a bad thing for capitalists. There is a crisis, their profits decline, the capital accumulation contracts. But if you think about it as a power process, in other words, my position as a capitalist relative to the position of other capitalists, it's virtually certain that some capitalists are going to lose more than others. In other words, even if you have a contraction of the process of accumulation of capital, you still have redistribution from some groups to other groups. And often this redistribution is extremely significant. And that's why we are saying that crisis is not something that capitalists necessarily fear from. Now, of course, crises are important insofar as they threaten the very regime of capital. For example, if there is a threat of nationalization, or if there is an even more serious threat of going towards socialism, that is something that causes capitalists to be fearful, and that is what happened during the 1930s and 1940s. But nowadays, when there is no real threat to the, if you like, hegemony of capitalism, then the issue is not really whether you have stagnation or growth, but the issue is the differential process of accumulation. Of course, crisis is something that involves risk. It might involve higher risk than the absence of crisis, but again, you are judging not the risk on its own, you are judging a risk in conjunction with the increase in profit. Again, if we take an example from the process of the accumulation of oil profits, there is no question that the oil companies are now faced with much higher risks than, say, in the 1960s, because the price of oil is extremely volatile. So this volatility means higher risk. But if you look at the actual profits have risen many, many times over. So if you add the increased risk, which is more than offset by the massive increase in profits, the net benefit for the oil companies is undisputed. And therefore, a crisis on its own is only part of the picture. And right now, when capitalism does not seem to be significantly challenged, I think that the risk of recession or the fear of recession is very mute.
If you can explain, how is it possible that while oil prices increase by a few dozens of percentage points, but the profits of oil companies multiply by several hundreds of percentages?
First of all, the price of oil has increased by more than a few dozen percents. I think that in 1999, the price of oil was around $10 a barrel. This was when the Economist of London wrote that the price of oil is heading down perhaps to $5 a barrel. Since that period, the price of oil has risen to about $75 presently. So it seems to me that this is an increase of over sevenfold since that period. So that's a pretty significant rise. Now, even when there is only a marginal change in price, often profits change by much more or by much less, because profit, remember, is a very bizarre category. It's a sort of a category that distills in it many, many different things. So the price of oil is just one factor. It's the price of the raw material that the oil companies buy, on which they add the cost of processing, of distilling the oil products, and on which they add their own markup. Now, the cost of distilling can change, and most significantly, the markup can change. If the price of oil, for example, rises by, say, 100%, if the markup remains the same and all other costs do not rise, then you might end up with a profit that is 100% higher. But if the markup rises by 50% as well, then you will have a much higher increase in profit. And it so happens often that markups tend to be positively correlated with the price of crude oil. So when the price of crude oil rises, so do the markups, and they further amplify the increase in profit.
Okay. I would like to get back to the issue of depth and breadth, as you mentioned before. We are now experiencing high growth rates in world economies. Is that a sign that we are, in fact, still within a regime of breadth?
The notion of breadth, as I suggested, is not directly synonymous with economic growth. Breadth means that the leading corporations accumulate differentially through more rapid entry into control over newly proletarianized populations and through mergers and acquisitions. Now, sometimes this is associated with economic growth. Sometimes it is not associated with economic growth. So the connection is not necessarily a very tight one. So I don't know that just on the basis of the measured growth rate of the world economy, we can draw this conclusion. We do know that mergers and acquisitions have risen significantly since the low point of 2003. We do know that entry into emerging markets, especially in Asia, is continuing very strongly. So in that sense, we do have a period of breadth, so it seems. At the same time, we do have continuing signs of crisis and risk, or the potential, if you like, for continuing inflation. So I would very much reserve judgment and not play and pretend to be an analyst that knows the future. I much prefer to wait for another 10 years and look backwards and see what has happened than to make here a statement about what will happen, because I don't think I know anybody else does.
All right, so let's look at the past then. In the graph that you present in the article Cheap Wars, you show a very strong correlation between relative profits of oil and weapon companies and wars that happened in the Middle East. And you've said before that the price of oil has risen because of these wars in the Middle East. So can you explain the causal relation? And more importantly, can you say there is also a causal relation in the other direction, meaning that the price of oil can also generate conflict in the Middle East?
Well, maybe I should first describe the graph that you refer to and what we have claimed was the relationship of some significance here. So what we did essentially is to try to think differently on conflicts in the Middle East. Most of the studies of Middle East conflicts take the statist perspective. In other words, they take their unit of analysis as the nation state, and they examine the behavior, action or lack of action of different states, and from that they try to describe and theorize the history of regional conflicts. Occasionally, this statist analysis is then connected to the other system of economics and the question of balance of trade, of movement, of redistribution of income between different states, etc. We try to look at the question from a completely different perspective, the perspective of differential accumulation, and to situate what happened in the political economy of the Middle East in the broader processes of global accumulation. So that is the context of how we try to understand the conflict differently. Now, specifically with respect to the chart that you mentioned, we looked at the performance. We didn't look at the intentions. We didn't look at the announcements. We didn't look at the analysis of oil companies. We looked at their financial performance, and we focused on the key variable of profitability. And we compare the profits of the leading six or seven oil companies, privately owned oil companies, to the performance of dominant capital as a whole, as approximated by the Fortune 500. And what we found was that the relative performance of the oil companies, in other words, whether they accumulate differentially relative to the Fortune 500 or they decumulate, in other words, they trail the average rather than beat it, we examined this performance over the period since the middle of the 60s until the present. So we plotted essentially a chart that shows every year by how much they beat the average or by how much they fall short of the average. And what we found is a remarkable relationship that has basically three features. The first feature is that every time that there is a situation in which the oil companies trail the average, their rate of return is below the Fortune 500, there follows an energy conflict in the Middle East. Energy conflict meaning a big conflict related to oil. Secondly, we found that after each one of those energy conflicts, the situation is reversed. In other words, the oil companies, instead of trailing the average, manage to beat the average. And thirdly, we found, with only one exception out of the 11 or 12 conflicts we counted, with only one exception, the oil companies never managed to beat the average without a conflict happening beforehand. So what we have here is not an explanation of a single conflict and not sort of an external connection between politics and economics. What we have here is a systematic description of all of these conflicts over a period of about 40 years that is able not only to systematically anchor them in the process of accumulation, but do it beforehand. In fact, we published this analysis first in the 1980s, and in that analysis we predicted the first Gulf War, and we also predicted the second Gulf War before it happened, invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. And this is not just a question of trick that we say, you know, we think it's going to happen. This is anchored in the same type of analysis that seems consistently in line with the facts for a period of about 40 years. So this is what we found. Now, this is not just a causal relationship. We're not claiming that essentially wars are driven by the oil companies, or that the oil companies are basically conspiring to generate war in the Middle East. We are arguing that this process is part of the global political economy of the Middle East, and it actually intertwines quite consistently with the movement of regimes, breadth and depth in the global political economy. So we're not basically producing here an alienated correlation between two different variables and say, aha, we found sort of the magic bullet here. No, this is an attempt to understand and portray an example of how differential accumulation provides a systematic, if you like, holistic perspective of power that gets translated, if you like, into the categories of capital accumulation. So in terms of causality, we are providing, I think, something much broader than just a mere correlation here. But of course, for that, people probably need to read more carefully. Me just putting a few slogans on the interview wouldn't really explain the argument in detail.
The next question I wanted to ask you is whether you can elaborate maybe on the role of Israel in the energy conflicts that you describe in the Middle East.
Again, it's hard to synthesize our argument into a few sentences right now. So I would basically just say that Israel has played a role that was significant in the generation and maintenance of many of these conflicts. Exactly how it played its role and how the relationship between Israel, direct and indirect, with the oil companies and armament companies, these are pretty complex issues that require somebody to actually read the history of the process. Israel is a direct participant insofar as it participated in many of the significant conflicts and wars and still continues to participate. But I don't think I'll venture here into starting to describe this process. It's much better read than explained verbally very briefly.
In that case, I would recommend to our readers to go to the website bnarchives.net where they could read further on this issue. And getting back to our discussion, I would like to ask you about the recent energy conflicts in the Middle East, the ones that the United States is participating in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And you've mentioned in the article Cheap Wars that the wars do not go so well for the United States. Would that also affect the capitalists in the United States? Is that a sign for the decline of U.S. hegemony in the world?
Oh, that's a big question for me to answer, because you are talking about whether the wars are going well or not, and whether this actually signifies the decline of U.S. hegemony. So maybe I'll talk about these questions separately, on these two issues of your question separately. First, on whether the wars are going well or not, again, I would much prefer to look at it in retrospect, but at the same time, there are certain things that I think already now can be said. There is a claim in some quarters that the war is hurting the U.S. economy, and some other quarters that the war is benefiting the U.S. economy. I'm not concerned with the U.S. economy, as you know. I'm focusing on profitability, and if you look at the profitability of the oil companies, there's no question that insofar as those wars have caused the price of oil to rise as opposed to fall, which was the conventional creed up until very recently, that this was the purpose of the war. It turns out that the wars have generated the exact opposite movement. That served the oil companies very well, as we already mentioned. It also served corporations that sell weaponry or equipment or services to the U.S. government very neatly, and their performance was much higher than the average in the United States. In terms of profitability in general, it's hard to argue that U.S. capitalists or owners of U.S. assets have suffered. If you look at the share of U.S. national income that goes to profit, in the last couple of years, the share of profit in national income has reached the highest level since 1929, when systematic data began to be collated. So on all of these levels that I mentioned, it seems that U.S. capitalists are doing pretty well. Whether this is because of the war or in spite of the war, that's another question that I don't think I can answer in, again, very few sentences. With respect to the question of the hegemony of the United States, again, it's a loaded question. At least for me, it is a loaded question, because I don't support this as the key question. I don't think this is the key question. If you think of the national entity of the United States from a standard economic perspective, this entity has been in the decline more or less since the 1950s and 60s. So the share of U.S. in global GDP has declined. Its share of global assets owned has declined. Its share of global exports has declined, etc. Since the 1970s and the defeat in Vietnam, the United States also politically has started to decline. So if there is, if you start with a steady student of analysis, I think that it's almost, seems almost to me evident that that entity has declined. But I would ask whether this emphasis, status emphasis, is really the relevant emphasis, because while the apparent influence of the U.S. government and U.S. policy and U.S. capitalists seems to have waned, what we have is a massive spread of capitalist principles. So what we have, if you like, is really the victory of the capitalist ethos, the victory of capitalist institutions, the victory of capitalist ideology, and whether it is American or not is probably less relevant. At least to me, it sounds less relevant.
So your alternative to the statist approach would be a study of institutions, a study of ideologies?
No, I don't think that that would characterize our thinking well. Again, we reject the bifurcation in the social sciences, the bifurcation that takes, the analysis of state as separately from the analysis of capital accumulation, as separate from the analysis of culture, etc. We try to move beyond that separation and say there is a universal process that is dominant in the world today. If you look for that universal process that is dominant, then that is the process of capitalization, and we argue differential capitalization. What we argue is not that this process is correlated with these statist approaches or ethnic approaches, etc. It encompasses them. Take, for example, something as removed from capital accumulation as climate change. If you look at the Stern report that came out recently in Britain about trying to sort out the cost and benefit of climate change, it uses the principles of capitalization. It tries to find how much it costs and how much it will cost to counteract climate change under different assumptions of interest rates, risk, changes in growth, etc. All of this uses the capitalist logic. You have many firms looking for experts in Islamic law in order to legitimize the entry of capitalist principles into Islamic countries. You have the launching of the most recent book in the Harry Potter saga, which is a work of art. It's literature, but most of the analysis of it is an analysis of capitalization, who profits from it, how, what is the risk involved, etc. So what we are arguing is that if you go from the statist analysis to culture to the ecology, all of these processes are increasingly subsumed under the single logic of capital accumulation. And therefore, we start with the single logic of capital accumulation and analyze these different processes as increasingly being understood to that logic. This is what we are arguing.
I see. Well, I would like to ask you to reconcile two things that you've just said before you started talking about issues of capital. You said that on the one hand, the United States has declined in terms of comparing the United States economy to the world economy. But you've also said that the United States has a record of foreign-generated profits right now. So is that not a contradiction?
I don't believe it is a contradiction. Let me try to be more precise in what I said. What I said is that if you take the statist perspective, if you accept that perspective and you accept the national accounting of stocks and flows, then it seems that the United States has been declining over the past 50 years. I also said, and we have written on this issue, that the United States records increasing proportion of profits generated from outside of the country, outside of the United States. But all of that assumes a statist perspective. If you don't have to, you don't have to assume that statist perspective. In other words, you can think of capitalists not as associated with a national entity. A lot of the U.S. capitalists are not U.S. capitalists at all. They happen to maybe reside or be registered in the United States, but they are global capitalists. So it is your choice to call them U.S. capitalists, but you don't have to. I don't call them U.S. capitalists. I call them capitalists. So it is one thing to look at the statist categories, accept them, and interpret them, and it is another thing to argue that these categories actually do not correspond to the most important questions we need to ask. In general, we argue that the association of capitalists with national entities is becoming increasingly meaningless.
Well, please forgive me for continuing a little bit more with this point, nevertheless, because would you agree that a growing number of these capitalists that happen to reside in the United States or who happen to be registered in the United States are in fact of different nationalities? There is a certain trend of more foreign capitalists entering the United States political economy.
Yes, I agree entirely. What we have is really a new phenomenon here, a new phenomenon in a historical context. If you look at the period of the late 19th century, the early 20th century, before the First World War, you have a period of heightened capital mobility. It's not as intense as the period of capital mobility we experience now, but it was pretty intense. What was special about that period, which is different from today, is that capital moved mostly in one direction. It moved from the core to the periphery. Nowadays, the situation is rather different. Nowadays, capital moves in both directions. So you have about one-third of all U.S. profits. U.S. profit essentially is profit that is recorded by the U.S. statistical agencies as accruing to entities that are registered in the United States. Now, between one-third and 45% of all U.S. profits come from outside of the United States. Now, in parallel, what we have is a massive influx of foreign capital into the United States. Again, the word foreign here is maybe a little bit anachronistic, but you have capital flowing from outside of the United States, a lot of it from East Asia, and right now, about one-fifth of all assets in the United States, and this is all assets, including homes and whatever you can think of, are owned by residents from outside of the United States. So we have a double-sided process in which ownership becomes decreasingly national-based. Now, if you project this process hypothetically into the future, let's say this process continues, capital flows out of the United States and into the United States. Eventually, you can reach a situation in which, say, 50, 60, 70% of all U.S. profits comes from outside of the U.S., and, say, 50% of all U.S. assets are owned by foreigners. It will become difficult at that point to speak of the U.S. capitalist class or of nationally based owners anymore. So we have a process in place that actually slowly diffuses the notion of a nationally associated capitalist class.
Yes, and this corresponds with your basic rejection of the statist approach. The more capital becomes a global thing. I would like now to ask you a few questions that concern Israel more than the United States. In your article, Israel's Roaring Economy, you argue that Israel is actually undergoing a very similar trend to the one that you've just described about the United States. Capital is becoming more increasingly detached from local ownership. What would make you make this claim?
Let me proceed by saying that, again, Israel is not unique in terms of experiencing the process you describe. As we just mentioned, the United States is experiencing it, but many other countries as well, South Africa, South Korea, Taiwan, even Japan is experiencing that process to a lesser extent. So this is a fairly universal process that started in the late 80s, early 90s, and is continuing. And this is a process that changes the underlying political economy of the world. Now, in terms of Israel, it is pretty pronounced. What you have nowadays, to the best of my knowledge, and I'd like to mention here that quite a lot of our research these days is not focused on the Israeli political economy. We've done a lot about it in the past, but nowadays we are working more on global questions and on theorizing the nature of capital. So my familiarity with the Israeli political economy is perhaps less intimate now than it used to be. But to the best of my knowledge, nowadays the numbers are about 20 to 25% of the Israeli stock market being controlled by so-called foreigners, in other words, by foreign pension funds, by transnational corporations, by Russian oligarchs, by you know, criminal money, what have you. Now, of course, these numbers tend to shift because capital is very liquid and it flows in and out. Most of the large firms today that operate in Israel are either teamed up with transnational corporations through joint ventures and joint ownership, or are subsidiary of transnational corporations. And the opposite is also the case. Many of the largest Israeli capitalists are no longer Israeli capitalists insofar as that Israel is merely a part of their portfolio. The largest Israeli family, or the most dominant Israeli family, up till the early 90s was the Rekenati family. And the Rekenati family is no longer an Israeli force. Basically, they divested their assets and they moved elsewhere. And that is perhaps not true with respect to all Israeli or so-called Israeli capitalists, but it is true to some extent that all of them now are heavily invested outside of the country. I came across this interesting quote from Lev Levayev, who is a Russian-born capitalist operating in Israel. And he was asked in a recent interview why he would not buy a bank in Israel. And his answer is quite telling. What he said was that he is really concerned that Israel is going to attack Iran, that Iran is going to retaliate with missiles. And the very thought of that happening, while he might be owning shares in an Israeli bank, in Israeli banks, is very scary for him. So essentially, he resides in Israel as well as in other places, but he thinks about Israel really in terms of an asset, in terms of a fraction of a portfolio, and what is going to happen to that portfolio if Iranian missiles happen to land in Israel. So that basically, I think, sums up the spirit and the outlook of most so-called Israeli capitalists nowadays.
Well, that quote by Lev Levayev brings me to my next question, actually. Israel is, perhaps unlike many other markets in the world, embroiled in continuous military conflict with its neighbors. And recent years show that the Israeli economy is actually undergoing massive growth rates. Would you say that this is another parallel between the United States economy and the Israeli economy?
I'm afraid I have to disagree. on several of your statements. Let me focus on one in particular. I don't think that the Israeli economy is going through massive growth. Neither by historical standards, nor by globally comparative standards. The Israeli economy is growing really at half or even less the rates that it was growing during the 60s and early 70s, 50s, 60s and 70s. And it is actually trailing the economies of China, India, and even the economy of the United States. So I would not start from this position. The Israeli economy is not roaring in that sense. This is not even getting into the question of what economic growth means in the first place. This is just using the standard information that comes to us from the statistical services.
Well, so I want to go a little bit deeper into that, actually.
Right.
But I want to follow the argument that you make in your article, Israel's Roaring Economy. The article has been written as a response to two articles that were quite widely distributed. One by Thomas Friedman, who wrote in the New York Times that Israel continues to prosper despite the arduous conflict it is engaged in because of a certain Jewish genius which makes Israeli companies produce a series of technological innovations that sustain the Israeli economy. What would your response be to his article?
Yes, the reason we wrote this article, I mean, I actually was not aware of Friedman's article and Naomi Klein's article, but I got an email from Doug Henwood, who publishes the Left Business Observer, and Doug is a very brilliant and artist researcher. And he asked me, you know, what is your response to this? What sense do we make of these claims, and then I read these couple of articles, and I sent them to Shimshon, and he read them too, and we decided to put a response to it, because what happens is that these articles essentially take for granted what is published in the capitalist media as if the Israeli economy is roaring, and then they go on to explain it without even checking the facts. So I just like to repeat to begin with that Israeli economy is not roaring. It's true that recently its growth rates have been somewhere around 5% in the last few years. But if you look at its growth rate over a prolonged period of time, in fact, it remains really by historical standards or by international comparisons not impressive at all. But let's just leave the facts for a moment aside and assume that these people are correct, and in fact the Israeli economy is roaring. What is the explanation of that? What do I make of Friedman's argument about the Jewish genius? This is a very dangerous argument to make, because if you take it on face value, that would mean that during the 1940s, when the U.S. economy was involved in a major war, despite being involved in a major war, its population, because of its Christian genius, generated massive economic growth. Now, this will also have to lead to the conclusion that this same population was composed of morons in the 1930s, because despite not being engaged in a military conflict, they didn't even manage to keep their GDP stable. The GDP has gone down. So this argument about religious or ethnic ingenuity is, I find, a little bit disconcerting. Perhaps Friedman should devise for us an ethnic/religious index. So according to that index, China, which grows at about 12%, has a Confucian genius that is the highest in the world, followed by the Hindu index of India, and then the Jewish index comes somewhere, at the bottom, because Israel GDP per capita is growing only at 3.3% compared, say, to 10% in China. I find it not worthwhile pursuing.
Okay, but the examples that you've just given about the United States in the 40s and as opposed to the United States in the 30s seem to indicate something that is not quite unlike the argument made by Naomi Klein. I think Naomi Klein cannot be accused of making a racist remark about the genius of Jews, but what she's arguing is that in her article, How War Has Turned Into a Brand, is that in fact the fact that Israel is embroiled in conflict is a source of profit for the Israeli military industry, and that is what explains Israeli growth rate. And what would your response be to her?
Well, I just, again, it's a difficult question to respond to, and I'd like to be careful in answering. First, again, Naomi Klein is explaining something that perhaps need not be explained because Israel is not growing as fast as she claims it grows. But again, suppose that there is a rapid growth to be explained. I don't think that Naomi Klein explains it. What she writes in her article is A, Israel exports arms. B, Israeli capitalists profit from these exports. And both of these statements I would not contest. I think that they are correct. But she makes a third argument that Israel is growing because of the export of armament and the profits from these armaments fuel the Israeli economy. And she does not substantiate that claim in any way. In other words, she makes those two claims and she connects them with a line, and that's the end of the argument. I find it not very convincing. If you look at the military spending and the history of military spending in Israel, overall military spending reached a peak in the 1970s, and it was about a third of GDP. Presently, it's about 8%. So there's been a significant decline relative to that period. Currently, only 6% of the total of the 8% is domestic military spending. The rest comes from the United States, and only about 3 or 4% is purchases from local industries. So, in terms of the history of military spending, there's been, like in the United States, a massive decline and demilitarization of the Israeli political economy. But again, in order to claim that one process drives the other process, you have to actually demonstrate it in some quantitative sense, because otherwise it becomes just a juxtaposition of two phenomena. It is not an explanation, and therefore it's very difficult to make sense of it. Now, I would suggest something completely different. If you look at the GDP per capita growth, which is what actually Naomi Klein and Thomas Friedman from the New York Times actually are concerned with, and that's the issue of prosperity and standards of living. If you look at GDP per capita growth and over a period extending to the 1950s in the United States, in Israel, and you examine that in conjunction with population growth, you see extremely tight correlation over a long period of time between these two developments. In other words, as the society experiences population growth, it generates processes that get recorded in the form of per capita growth. And that could occur either because of immigration or because of a process of proletarianization, as we see in China and India. This has very little to do with militarization. It has very little to do with demilitarization, etc. But I'm not excluding the possibility that Naomi Klein is correct. I'm just saying she has provided no evidence whatsoever. And again, personally, I'm not particularly concerned with economic growth measures per se, because I don't think that they actually reflect the central processes of capitalism, and they themselves are dubious concepts. The process of economic growth is
This is a point I would like you to elaborate on, indeed, because when you are saying that in fact the Israeli economy is not undergoing prosperity right now in historical comparisons or in international comparisons, are you still using the GDP as a measurement, the GDP growth rate? And if not, what is in fact wrong with using GDP growth rates?
Well, in our article, Israel's Roaring Economy, we said explicitly that we are using the standard measures because in order to challenge the conventional approaches both on the right and the left, you challenge them in their own terms. So they're using the official statistics, and so did we. But I think these official statistics are potentially very, very misleading. First, I already mentioned that we are interested mostly in the processes of capital accumulation, and economic growth is just not a very useful and sometimes not sufficient to understand the processes of accumulation. But even if you look at the issue of well-being, it's very dubious to use GDP growth as an index of well-being. Let me explain that, because these are usually treated as economic matters that most people start to yawn when they hear about, but this is quite important. If, for example, we close down a factory that produces $1 million worth of medicine, and instead we open a factory that produces $1 million worth of chemical weapons, the GDP is not going to change. Why? Because our measurements of GDP assume that a dollar that is being produced is equivalent in terms of its contribution to the GDP as any other dollar, no matter what you produce. So if you produce imbecile television programs, if you produce security services that secure nobody, if you produce massive pollution, if you produce all sorts of services that are really not necessary and cause quite a bit of harm to most human beings, but if all of those services and products actually cost money and are sold on the market, they are counted as addition to GDP. So the very measurement of GDP assumes that the market is right and that the market actually tells us what is the worth in terms of our standard of living. And that's the only measure that we have. So that's one criticism, and again, this is not an original criticism of me or in our writing. This is a common criticism against the GDP measure. Another important criticism has to do with the distribution of growth. When you're measuring average measures, you say nothing about how they are distributed among the members of society. Israel was one of the most egalitarian countries in the world, actually, during the 1950s and even during the 1960s. And nowadays, it records one of the most unequal distribution of income in the world, comparable to Latin America. You have processes of hunger, homelessness among the Jewish population in Israel, things that were unheard of maybe even 10 years or 15 years ago. Now, a lot of the process of growth involves a massive redistribution of income and resources between segments of society, and that is not reflected at all in the aggregate statistics. So I would, on these three grounds, question the very usefulness of economic growth as a measure, A, because it does not reflect directly on the processes of accumulation and the processes of power, B, it does not really tell us much about well-being unless we accept what the market tells us about well-being, and C, it tells us nothing about the distribution of well-being, even if we are able to measure it.
Well, in that case, what would be your choice of indicators to measure standard of living or well-being of the population?
Well, that will require another interview.
Okay, all right then. So in that case, let me move to a different topic and get back to the issue of capital, which you've mentioned before. You're saying that you do not see capital as an economic entity, but in fact as a form of power. If ownership changes hands, does that mean that power also changes hands? And if ownership of Israeli capital assets changes hands into the hands of international investors, does that mean that the power of the Israeli state or the Israeli agenda is diminished?
I think anybody who lives in Israel today and has either knowledge or even memories of Israel, say, of the 60s and even if the 70s, does realize that politics has changed a great deal, and the stature of politicians today is quite different than the stature of politicians then. Back then you would talk about the omnipotence of, you know, the finance minister the significance of the inner cabinet and things like that. Nowadays it sounds like a joke. Now, a lot of people claim that this is some sort of a deterioration in the culture of the country, etc. But I think that there might be much deeper reasons for it that have to do with the changing nature of ownership that you mentioned. Because if you think about capitalism as we do, as the central process of society, then the capitalist owners, the leading capitalists, the dominant capitalists, they form the center or the core of the ruling class. Now, say up until the 1980s, most of the Israeli capitalists were deeply embedded in their society. It's true that they had foreign investments, and it's true that there were foreigners that were operating in the country. But there was a clear sense of an inside and an outside. And the Israeli capitalist class was very much intertwined with the dynamics of the political economy and the evolution of Israel, directly and indirectly. And nowadays there is a break. In other words, capitalists do not appear to be directly involved in determining so-called politics, either domestic or foreign policy in Israel. And I would submit that a large part of the reason is because of their transition from being Israeli to being global, because of this diversification, because ownership changes ends, and because ownership is a claim on power. It's a reflection of power. It's nothing to do with the ownership of productive assets. It has nothing to do with the generation of utility. It has to do with the ability to shape society. But this ability is increasingly fractured as far as any particular capitalist is concerned. So all of these capitalists have some assets in Israel, but these assets are simply too small for them to actually have an interest in spending time, effort, and investment in controlling the future of those assets. It's much easier to sell if the circumstances change than to invest in changing the circumstances. And that's a simple cost-benefit calculation that every individual capitalist is engaged in. But if you take the aggregate of capitalists and all of them shift from being mostly embedded in an Israeli context to being only partly or and insignificantly embedded in an Israeli context, that means that there is no clear capitalist element that mines the store. So there is a shift in the nature of the ruling class. And the ruling classes all over the world, it seems to me, are changing from being domestically embedded to being globally embedded, and that changes the nature of domestic politics. So yes, the answer is definitely politics changes because the nature of the ruling class becomes increasingly transnational.
Well, to conclude, I would like to ask you one more question about how this shift in ownership of capital affects the political opportunities regarding Israel. As you've said, that capital is the power which enables the owner to shape societies. Recently, the Presbyterian Church in the United States decided to divest from companies that are involved in the occupation of Israel, the occupation that Israel occupies the Palestinian territories. Would you say that the new nature of capital ownership changes the ability of such divestment efforts to affect policies?
I think that we can divide the answer into two. In principle, because capital is becoming ever more dominant as a form of power, let me say it, although it's a little late to mention it, but it's not too late. Capital is not the only form of power. there are many other forms of power. Our claim is that capital increasingly encompasses other forms of power and increasingly becomes the dominant form of power in capitalist societies. Now, with this in mind, obviously, a capital strike, if capitalists decide collectively to boycott Israel, then the effect is going to be dramatic, because if capital is power and you basically use this power as a leverage and essentially divest from Israel, the effect is going to be very significant. First of all, if let's just hypothetically assume that all movement of capital into Israel stops cold turkey, and that investors, foreign investors, start to pulling out of Israel. The immediate effect is going to be a crash of the stock market, a crash of the currency, and a massive increase in interest rates in order to try to restrict that outflow, which means a massive recession. So the effect is going to be enormously painful on Israeli society and the capitalists that actually are invested in Israel. But the next question is, how feasible is an action like that? So although the effect is going to be dramatic, it's not at all certain that it's actually feasible to engage in such an action. Remember, it's not labor unions that are doing it, and most assets are not controlled by churches. So if a particular organization that is politically correct or genuinely concerned decides to divest from Israel, the chances are that there will be 10 or 100 other investors who are going to see that as an investment opportunity and are basically going to fill the gap. The only way that this can happen effectively is if it is enforced. Because of the multifaceted nature of individual capital investments, the likelihood of all capitalists taking this more perspective and more high grounds regarding Israel is very slim. They will do so only if they are compelled to do so, and only if this decree is being enforced. But who is going to enforce this decree? The United States, the EU, China? There is no force that is likely to enforce this type of movement. So it seems to me that although the potential for such action, or the impact of such action, rather, is going to be very large, the likelihood of actually implementing it and furthermore sustaining it seems rather remote. So, of course, it placates the consciousness of investors who are concerned with what Israel is doing. But beyond that, they're basically just, opening an entry for alternative investors to step in.
Well, Professor Nitzan, thank you very much for your time, and I would like to invite our listeners one more time, if you're interested in more information by Jonathan Nitzan and Shimshon Bichler, visit their website at bnarchives.net. And thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The Alternative Information Center is a joint Palestinian-Israeli organization which prioritizes political advocacy, critical analysis, and information sharing on the Palestinian and Israeli societies, as well as on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In doing so, the AIC promotes responsible cooperation between Palestinians and Israelis based on the values of social and political justice, equality, solidarity, community involvement, and respect for the full inalienable national rights of the Palestinian people. The AIC believes that true social cooperation and communication between Palestinians and Israelis is possible. We have embodied this ideal for the past 20 years through our joint and collective structure. However, we acknowledge that this can only come to pass in the region if the root cause of the conflict is targeted and challenged, that being the long occupation and dispossession of the Palestinian people. Based on these convictions, the AIC will continue to work towards the establishment of genuine and responsible grassroots bridges between the two communities. The AIC's activities and publications provide a critical discussion of the political realities that shape the current situation, with special attention given to the radical democratic and feminist struggles, critical perspectives on the colonial nature of Israel and the alarming authoritarian features that have emerged in the Palestinian Authority. For more information, please go to our website at www.alternativenews.org.